Hello and welcome to this extra inning of The Ballpark, a podcast from the Phelan US Centre here at the London School of Economics. I'm Chris Gilson, Managing Editor of the Phelan US Centre's blog on US politics and policy, USAP. In March 2024, I spoke to Professor John Owen. Professor John Owen is the Ambassador Henry J. and Mrs. Marion R. Taylor Professor of Politics and Senior Fellow at the Institute of Advanced Studies in Culture at the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. From January through June 2024, he is an academic visitor at Nuffield College at the University of Oxford. Professor Owen studies the way that ideologies and cultures shape international relations and vice versa. We spoke about his new book, The Ecology of Nations, American Democracy in a Fragile World Order. We also talked about the US's changing foreign policy objectives and the move from welfare liberalism to open liberalism in the post-war period and beyond. Well, thank you so much for coming on The Ballpark today. It's great to have you. Could you just start out by talking a little bit about your current research and work? Thank you.
Yes. So last year, I published a book, which I know we're going to be talking about, The Ecology of Nations, subtitle American Democracy and a Fragile World Order. And this follows a number of years of work I've done on trying to figure out if democracies, liberal democracies, really are different in the way they conduct their foreign policies and the international outcomes. When you have a group of democracies as opposed to a random sample of states, do the outcomes differ? Now I've turned that around and started to look at how the outside affects the inside. In other words, not just how do democracies affect international relations, but how do international relations affect democracies? And does it actually help make them more democratic or less democratic? So that's the basic thing I'm looking at. The book looks at it. I'm spinning off a couple of articles from that, one on the really intense, if quiet, competition between the United States and the West on the one hand, and China, and to some extent Russia on the other, over the content of international order. So I discuss this in the book a lot, but I think that this competition is really related to the overall security competition between China and the United States. But I think the field of international relations neglects that connection or maybe isn't fully aware of it. So that's one thing I'm trying to get across in some current work, that when you look at China and the United States tussling over the content of a trade agreement or the human rights rules or discourse globally, it's not just about that. It actually is about, in some identifiable ways, it's about the overall competition between China and the United States more generally. So,
as you said, your new book is The Ecology of Nations, American Democracy in a Fragile World Order. Could you just give our listeners a brief overview of the book and its main themes and your arguments in it? Thank you.
Yes. The title can be a little misleading. I've gotten some emails from people saying, oh, I want to study environmental politics with you. And I have to write them back and say, well, that's not me, but I know why you wrote me. It's the title of the book. So the ecology is meant in the more general sense of the environment. And I don't mean the natural environment. I mean the social environment. So what do I mean by that? Why do I use that terminology? I'll start out by talking about the puzzle or the set of puzzles that got me interested in the ecology of nations. And it really comes down to the fact that it's harder for countries to be democracies today in the third decade of the 21st century than it was a few decades ago in the 1990s. And I say that because coming from the United States, of course, the American democracy is wobbling. Let's just say it's been wobbling for a while. Americans, you know, it's a big country. They sometimes forget. They don't pay that much attention to the rest of the world. But a lot of countries are going through something similar. So we're in Europe, in the UK, some similar phenomena on this side of the Atlantic and other democracies in other parts of the world as well. So when I look at that, I think, and the story was quite different in the 1990s. Again, more democracies, the idea, the dominant idea then was, there's no point in not being a democracy. Democracy has won the contest of ideas, and it's just a matter of time until China becomes a liberal democracy as well. And I'm old enough to remember these years vividly. It's a very different time to be alive, really, and to be an adult. So what's going on here? Why is it that sometimes you have more democracies and democracies feel like the future is theirs, and other times not so much? Or let's take it back one more, remove the 1930s. 1930s, also hard to be a democracy. Democracies in Europe and Latin America, almost in North America, are really crumbling. And fascism is on the rise. And then the Soviet Union is sort of doing its own thing, but it's also not a liberal democracy. So there was something also going on there in the world, just roughly speaking, that seemed to be making it harder to stay democratic, to become democratic, right? Easier to become fascist. So again, I see something environmental or ecological going on there, and we don't quite know what that is. There are a lot of different ideas. So one thing I try to do in the book is, the main thing I really try to just flesh that out. What is going on that makes it easier or harder at different times and places to be democratic? And I adopt the language of evolution, evolutionary biology, and environmental engineering and those sorts of fields, because they really have thought hard for a long time about agents in their environment and how the environment shapes, or, and here I'll adopt the term they use, select for. So I make a fairly strong claim in the book that the international environment can select for democracy or select for authoritarianism, depending on what's in that environment. And by select for, I really mean something like what biologists mean. They are talking about populations of organisms. So over time, if a snowy environment selects for animals with white fur, and everyone knows this story, I think, over time, the animals with white fur have a reproductive advantage over those who don't. So over time, you have more of them. Countries are different. Countries don't die and reproduce in the same way, but they live on and they do change. They change their ways. They change the way they're organized. They change their policies, their leadership, and so on, in response to outside pressures. All right. So that's a kind of, if I can say, theoretical apparatus I employ. It's borrowed from the natural sciences. But what does that have to do with the problems we're facing now in democracy? And I say, my bottom line is my own home country, the United States, which is the liberal hegemon. It's very powerful, has a lot of influence. Lots of people over here are paying attention to the presidential election that's coming in the United States in the fall. I know why that is, because it's not just about the United States, right? So that's really my main focus, but the book is about other democracies as well. Two problems, really, that you can trace to the international environment. And the first one is, for a number of years, the liberal international order, which is part of the international environment, that was, in fact, constructed by the United States with great assist from the UK and other countries at the end of the Second World War. For a number of years, that order, which consists of lots of institutions and rules, has not been selecting for democracy. That has not been intentional. It did select for democracy in the decades after World War II. It did that pretty well. It was designed in a way to do that. The American and British leaders wouldn't put it in those evolutionary terms. They would use different jargon, but it was working. It has stopped working. We've made some changes that made a lot of sense at the time in the 70s and 80s, but they're not working anymore. And to be, there's a lot going on in that claim, but I'll talk about, an obvious example that other people have written about, globalization, the opening of national economies to each other, to each other's goods, services, capital or money, and to some extent labor, has increased overall wealth, but it has really created lots of what economists call losers in a number of industrial economies. So one example is China's membership in the World Trade Organization, which is something I favored in the 90s. The Clinton administration and the Bush administration made it happen with China. An economist at MIT, David Autor, says that about 2.4 million manufacturing jobs were lost in the first decade of this century just because of the opening to China, because China is part of the WTO. And that has caused, it's been great for China, it's been great for many Americans, but it really has been bad for lots of Americans and lots of communities. This is part of this larger phenomenon of the disruptions of globalization under the liberal international order that the United States mostly designed and is kind of putting out there, but it feeds back into U.S. politics and society. Deliberately so. That it was set up to do that. And the disruptions have led to the rise of populism. And populism is a complex topic. But the bottom line for me is the kind of populism that's dominant in the United States now has, let's just say, questionable commitment to liberal democracy, right? This is a real-time problem, all right? So let me back up and say the evolutionary language I use in the book is not just about the environment selecting for a particular set of, for democracy or autocracy. It also is about what some biologists call coevolution, which is when a particularly strong species can manipulate the environment and change the traits that it selects for. All right, so here, my favorite case of this is the story of how the world got long-toothed beavers. And the story that, it's a stylized story, but the story that some zoologists tell is, well, you once had a world where some of the beavers had short teeth and weren't very sociable. Others had long teeth. Some of those were sociable. Those with long teeth and that were highly sociable had an advantage because they could cut down trees and build dams together. And so that gave them a reproductive, it gave them more food. It gave them an advantage over time. The beavers don't know they're doing this. They're just cutting down trees and trapping food with their dams. But the effect is they are manipulating the environment so that it selects for long teeth when it would not have done so before. So that sounds really far removed from international relations. But my argument is, great powers like the United States do this pretty routinely. They mold the environment to select, to give themselves an advantage, and it ends up selecting for them in a way it would not have otherwise done. So the United States did this after World War II pretty effectively. It has kept doing it, but it's been doing it wrong, or at least it's made some crucial mistakes for about 40 years. So in other words, part of the problem is it's on us. It's especially the United States, the most powerful liberal state. There's a second problem, which is the rise of China and the persistence of Russia, both of these as authoritarian capitalist powers. Back in the 90s, as I said a minute ago, the smart money seemed to be on China and Russia becoming liberal democracies. Why not? All the other countries were doing it, and the Soviet Union had fallen, and China was already adopting, had already been adopting capitalism. But something happened between the 90s and now. Both countries have settled into what looks like a long-term authoritarianism of different sorts. China and Russia don't have identical regimes, but one party dominates. They're capitalists with heavy state-owned sectors and so on and so forth. And the problem there is not just one for Chinese and Russians or Ukrainians or Taiwanese. It's really for international order because and I'll focus more on China, which is, I think, the more consequential country. The Chinese have done very well under this liberal international order that I was just talking about. They have their economy has grown by leaps and bounds until recently. Because of some smart decisions they made in the late 70s and 80s, namely opening their economy in a measured way to this liberal international order. But they have never liked certain features of that order. Human rights regimes, human rights discourse, which have, in their minds, are used to humiliate them, to give countries excuses to impose economic sanctions on them. More recently, the global regime on the internet. So the United States has always wanted a completely open internet, open all the time to everything. It's the Silicon Valley way. Europe, a little more guarded, right? More regulated. But China really wants the national censorship, or as they would call it, internet sovereignty, to be the global norm. They are often called out for the so-called Great Firewall, for not allowing their people to read and exchange ideas freely the way it happens in the democracies. And here's this is another thing they want to change. They don't want to be in any sense ostracized or subject to economic sanctions or anything like that, right? Also in trade agreements, the Chinese want to make some changes in the way we do, the way international finance, international lending is done. They have a giant Belt and Road Initiative, a huge infrastructure project all over the global south and into Europe. And most of it's financed through these fairly opaque arrangements through China, state-owned banks from China. And the Chinese want to make this normative so that it's just the way you do, right? So all this means, and China has leverage, is able to maybe bring about some of this. They're working the problem at the United Nations and other places. And so this is a slower moving problem than the first problem. The America has been pumping the wrong kind of liberalism out into the world, but it's still a long-term problem. And I think part of the problem, the larger problem the United States and China have had, a lot of it's about Taiwan and the naval arms race in the South China Sea. A lot of it's about trade. A lot of it's about the shape of international order, because each country knows that if it is able to shape international order more than the other, it gives it a real advantage, a competitive advantage, right? So there's a lot at stake in this. And the problem for democracy is if the international order in a few decades from now is more along China's preferences, with weaker human rights covenants, with opaque international financing, there will be more authoritarian states. That's the claim I make in the book. So China is, given that it's a single party Leninist state, the government's doing what's in their interest. They're not being peculiarly evil here. They're just doing what's in their interest as an authoritarian great power. So that's I threw a lot at you there, but those are the two big claims of the book about what's wrong, what's going wrong for democracy in the United States and in other countries as well.
Thank you so much for that. My next question actually kind of speaks to your point about, which I thought was really interesting, about that kind of the selection, that kind of the ability to for the US and countries to influence that external, those external selection forces. And you talked about how the US may have gotten it wrong in the last few decades. In your book, you argue that one of the US's primary foreign policy objectives over the last half century has been to make the environment more liberal through three historic stages. Could you talk a bit about what each of these stages are and how they've worked in the past and why they may not be effectively working now?
Yes, I have an argument about liberalism in general. What is it? This is a huge topic political theorists spend their entire careers on. But I'm convinced that a really useful way to think about liberalism is it has changed in the way it, in its outworkings, in the policies that it calls for. Liberalism itself, I take to be a pretty abstract claim about the liberty of the individual, that the highest political good is individual freedom. All right. So most people in liberal democracies like the sound of that. Yeah, individual freedom. What's not to like? That's not the only thing that matters, but it matters. Maybe it matters a lot. It's such an abstract claim. It's been around for more than 200 years. It's such an abstract claim that it needs filling in a bit. And over time, over the centuries, political thinkers, politicians, writers, ordinary people have filled it in different ways. So the original liberalism of the 18th and most of the 19th century is what we call classical liberalism. And each kind of liberalism, I should say, asks the following question: what is the chief threat to individual liberty right now in our time? What is it? So originally, classical liberalism said the chief threat, and this is, again, going back into the 18th century, is the despotic state. Absolute monarchy, the alliance of throne and altar. And what's the remedy? Well, we need to shrink the state, because it's the state that's squashing individual freedom. Now, what classical liberals meant by individuals is more restricted than what we mean. It was usually property owning adult white males, and certainly in my home country, that was the what was meant. The property owning requirements were relaxed in the 19th century and so on, but nonetheless still restricted. But so classical liberalism worked pretty well on the whole for a while. The Industrial Revolution of the 19th century, though, began to create problems. And this is a familiar story. Marxists tell it, liberals tell it. The Industrial Revolution entailed lots of mechanization of production, people moving to cities in vast numbers, and the creation of a completely new type of person, the working class, right? So, and the problem with the working class and classical liberalism was classical liberalism claims that individuals are autonomous. So when an employee goes to work for an employer, it's a freely entered bargain and you don't have to pay attention to who has more leverage. It's just you're selling your labor to an employer. And the working class, we're definitely getting the short end of that deal to the point where lots of liberals starting really in the UK, late 19th century, began to say, you know, we liberals are for individual liberty. But when I look at our big cities, and I see these huge numbers of factory workers, when I look at the miners, because this is also coal gets mined in much bigger way than it had before to feed the factories. These miners, these factory workers don't look free to me. They look actually quite coerced. They're not able to really bargain with employers. The employers have the upper hand always. So liberals began, some liberals, not all, some liberals began to think about how can we rethink individual liberty? What are good laws? What are good policies that can extend liberty or re-extend liberty to this huge number of people? It's a majority of citizens, maybe. And so there emerged in the late 19th and early 20th centuries what we call welfare liberalism, which saw, the long and short of it is, in order to empower the new working class, it thought that the state needs to regulate capitalism more. So laws about the length of the work week, about collective bargaining. So labor unions, trade unions could organize and collectively bargain with employers. Pension systems, universal health systems began to crop up, or the ideas for them. So so here the liberals are asking, what's the greatest threat to individual liberty? It's no longer the despotic state, because we've taken care of that. We have a liberal democratic state now. It's unfettered capital. That's really what's holding individuals back, or most of them, or a lot of them. And so welfare liberalism is, the Labor Party in this country, in the United States, actually the Republican Party with the progressive movement got there first, but it really took hold in the Democratic Party later during the Great Depression. It's really in the Great Depression that welfare liberalism becomes predominant. It was such a crisis with millions and millions of unemployed adult men that policymakers were ready to try all sorts of experiments. And so welfare liberalism in the American case takes hold in the New Deal, we call it. All right. So that's the second type of liberalism. And I should say, under classical liberalism, the previous, and looking mostly at the United States followed the kind of laissez-faire approach of classical liberalism when it came to foreign policy. The United States mostly didn't have this idea of building multinational institutions. It wanted to trade with as many countries as possible, and it wanted the Western Hemisphere to consist of republics. This is important. It did not want monarchies in the Western Hemisphere. So classical liberalism dictated to the United States, in the 1820s, there were a number of revolutions in Latin America, tossing off monarchical rule, installing republics. And the Monroe Doctrine of 1823 was in large part about making sure the European monarchies didn't come back and reimpose monarchy in Latin America. And the Americans were quite serious about this because they thought a Latin America with Spanish and French monarchs is not going to be friendly. It wasn't friendly before. We don't want it back, right? Welfare liberalism, the second stage liberalism, comes to dominate much later in the 1930s, has a very different approach to international order. It's much more active, regulatory. It really requires building multinational institutions. One reason for that is if you have a set of capitalist economies that are intervening, or governments that are intervening in their economies and the money supply and the tax rate, and they trade a lot with each other and invest in each other's economy, they need to coordinate their policies. In the 30s, there was really no accepted set of mechanisms to do that. And so after World War II, the United States, Britain, and other countries built up this liberal international order, partly to make welfare liberalism work better within their countries. That is to say, they wanted to preserve liberal democracy in its then current form, right? So that's why they began to mold the international environment. Welfare liberalism then has a few good decades, the 40s, the 50s, the 60s. These are in some ways wonderful decades for the economies of the wealthy industrial democracies. But welfare liberalism starts to encounter trouble in the 70s. Inflation is a big problem and it's not going away, and unemployment is staying high. And the word that emerged, the ugly word, is stagflation, high unemployment, high inflation. And welfare liberals began to admit, you know, we're trying all the tricks we have in our bag of tricks and nothing seems to be working. Well, there's a third kind of liberalism, sort of waiting in the wings, that sounds a bit like classical liberalism, but I argue it is different. And I call it open liberalism. So it has some features of classical liberalism. It prefers a smaller state footprint in the economy. So deregulation, cutting taxes, supposedly less redistribution of wealth, though there's still some of that going on. But open liberalism is also more cosmopolitan than classical liberalism was. The goal really is to maximize economic growth all over the world. Classical liberalism's view was more about the country. So Adam Smith, way back, 1776, he publishes a book that's a classical liberal text, maybe the central text of the movement. It's called The Wealth of Nations. He didn't call it The Wealth of Mankind, as he might have, or The Wealth of Humanity. Open liberalism is more about that. It really, and some of the most influential people in open liberalism coming out of the Austrian school, the Chicago school of economics, really see states as a barrier, kind of a legacy problem for economic growth, because they create artificial barriers to economic interaction, transactions. And so the goal here really is to pull down as many barriers, national barriers, to the free movements of goods, services, capital, and labor as possible. And so that's the economic side of open liberalism. So open liberals ask the same question: what in our time in the 1970s, what's the greatest barrier to individual liberty? It's no longer the despotic state. It's no longer unfettered capital. It's these boundaries. National boundaries, but also customary boundaries that are holding us back from economic efficiency. And I'll say one more thing about all these liberalisms. They bring with them each brings a culture with it. And I'm not one of those social scientists who thinks, well, we have to decide if culture is more important than economics. I think they're really entangled. They're mutually supporting. So the culture of classical liberalism way back was the independent entrepreneur, or in the U.S. context, the cowboy, the man who moves his family west and finds more land, but is an independent operator. That's virtue. That, you know, welfare liberalism's culture was something different. It really was one of a stable family, man at the head of the household. There was a real conformity after the Second World War. You can see it in, I mentioned this in the book, you dig out a high school yearbook from 1955, and I still have these at my house. All the high school kids look the same. You know, the boys have short hair, the girls clearly wore curlers the night before, and they look older than high school students do now. They also look, there's a real conformity. That's the face of welfare liberalism. So it had many good things, but it had a certain conformity. The culture of open liberalism is much more experimental, fluid. Not just about autonomy, but really self-creation. And it comes out of the 1960s counterculture. It was a reaction against the conformism of welfare liberalism. But it's of a piece with the economic program, which is Barriers are, generally speaking, both cultural and economic, are a hindrance to human progress and human freedom. And we need to get rid of them as far as we can. And this is just not the thinking of welfare liberalism. It was, no, we want security, stability, boundaries are a good thing, right? So we have open liberalism now, and I've just unfolded you this story about how I think we got here. I'll say one last thing about open liberalism. It's done a lot of good things, has many features to admire. I think it hastened the demise of the Soviet Union. It really did jack up economic growth in the West, and it had a lot of transnational cultural appeal in the Soviet Union and other places. But the problem is it has led to this economic and cultural program that has, I think, damaged democracy by polarizing societies, by pitting working class and rural people, who tend to have more welfare liberal values, I would say, against urban, suburban people who are all in with open liberalism. So I think this is part of the polarization problem that in turn leads to populism, populist politicians and movements that are really causing democracy to wobble.
So in your book, you mentioned that a multilateral trade organization that includes both rich and poor countries can potentially undermine democracy and its rich members. Could you talk a bit more about why this is and how this insight changes how we might view organizations like NAFTA, EU-CTA, the WTO, and maybe globalization more generally?
Right. So the point really is one you encounter in an introductory class on trade, but it's the abstract point is if you have two countries, rich countries tend to have a relative scarcity of labor and a relative capital is quite plentiful in wealthy countries, and the opposite is true in poor countries. Capital is relatively scarce and labor is relatively plentiful. So when these two countries open their economies to each other, when they start trading more, let's say, labor in the rich country does worse and labor in the poor country is better. Capital in the rich country does better than capital in the poor country. What that means, to flesh the point out a little bit, let's take NAFTA, which President Trump sort of ended, but then put something in place that's very much like NAFTA. So Mexico's per capita wealth is well below that of the United States. I could talk about China as well. Let's just talk about Mexico and NAFTA. Canada and the United States are pretty similar. U.S. is a little bit higher, but not much. But Mexico per capita, not nearly so wealthy. So the cost of labor per unit is a lot lower in Mexico. The wages are lower. For good reason, cost of living is lower. So all else equal, talking the way economists talk, all else equal, open trade between the United States and Mexico, or Canada and Mexico for that matter, will disrupt both economies. It'll disrupt the U.S. economy by taking jobs and moving them, so to speak, to Mexico. Because U.S. Investors in the U.S. economy are going to say, you know what, we could build that Ford automobile, same qualities, a lot more cheaply in Mexico. We just need to build factories, but they have quite a labor force and wages and pensions and so on are a lot lower. So this is a familiar story. That's what I mean by now. Everyone, economists, trade negotiators, all know this. This is not a surprise. David Ricardo wrote about this 200 years ago. So they do it because they think the price is worth paying. The benefit has to do with the increase in national income. So American U.S. consumers, the people who buy the cars, are better off under this deal because the cars are cheaper, or at least the prices don't rise as high. Why? Because they're cheaper to produce. You're getting the same quality. Right. So what's not to like? Well, if you're an automobile factory worker, there might be something really not to like. You're out of work and you have to retrain, or you retire early or something like that. So multiply that by thousands and thousands and thousands of people. And that's what I mean. So the price of globalization for many people has been higher than they thought. governments also, and this is true in Europe, when you know, this is a longstanding customs union in the European Union, lots of labor displacement there as well. Governments have always promised, well, we'll retrain you. It's okay. Well, and you'll be better off, actually. Government retraining, certainly in the United States, has not been what it's been promised. So that has compounded the problem, I would say. Yeah.
So do you see the move from welfare liberalism of the post-war period to the more open liberalism of today as kind of being in one direction? Or do you see any possibility, or have you seen evidence of a shift back towards a more welfare liberalism-oriented environment?
Yes, I do argue in terms of unidirection in a kind of a simple sense that I think the three liberalisms I posit, classical, welfare, and by the way, those are not my original terms. I didn't make them up. I owe a debt to lots of other scholars for those. Open liberalism is probably my term, and I'm not completely happy with it. But anyway, let's say that's my thing. But I argue open liberalism is not, as some would have it, a simple return to classical liberalism. It's something new. It has some features of classical liberalism, but it's really doing something new. And I would say to your very good question that what comes after open liberalism, whatever that is, won't be just welfare liberalism for the 21st century. There's a reason why welfare liberalism was abandoned in the late 20th century. It just wasn't able to handle a modern economy. And the reasons why are, you know, smarter people than I will have to explain that one, but it's quite clear. And it was such a huge consensus in the 70s. It just isn't working. So the thought of returning wholesale to something like the way the French or the British or the American economy worked in 1955, it's you may like to think about it. Nice thought experiment. Too difficult to pull off. And the culture, also the cultural welfare liberalism, I think is just not appealing to lots of people in the 21st century. So that said, these liberalisms they're not radically different from each other. So just as open liberalism has some features of classical and of welfare liberalism, you know, the open liberal regimes have retained a lot of social insurance schemes of welfare liberalism. What follows open liberalism may well, and I think it ought to, people who are working the problem ought to look back at some of the features of welfare liberalism and think, can we adopt at least some of this? So one would be, and I don't have a strong opinion about this, but I think one thing to consider is capital controls. So some economists have called for this. This is when a country has foreign investment. So the automobile example, Ford builds an auto factory in Mexico, or BMW builds an auto factory in South Carolina in the United States. And BMW suddenly decides, well, this is not working out, right? The cars aren't, the quality of the cars isn't, or the workers have unionized suddenly. We didn't know they're going to do that. And so their demands are too big. So we'll just close the factory and build another one somewhere else that's more congenial. Under open liberalism, by and large, they can just do that. They can pull their capital out. This is obviously very disruptive to the town where the BMW factory is, right? So capital controls, which was the kind of rule before open liberalism, says countries can actually exert some control over whether and how fast the capital is pulled out. Now, there's a problem here. Companies know this. Companies generally avoid countries that have capital control because they know this. If they ever want to pull their investment out, it might be hard to do. In some cases, they may have to pay bribes. In some cases, they just can't do it. So they'll be reluctant to invest there. So it's a tricky problem. But it's something that used to be the rule of thumb. And I think it's worth looking at because capital movements, while they're wonderful creating and sustaining wealth and maximizing returns to shareholders, they also disrupt not just individual life, but families and entire communities, and can do that quite quickly. So that's an example of the sort of thing that maybe it's time to think about more about the way welfare liberalism handled this particular question. And you could say similar things about immigration, about trade, and so on.
So in what ways are Russia's Vladimir Putin and China's Xi Jinping attempting to reverse engineer the environment to make it maybe more open to sovereign democracy or capitalist autocracy?
Yes, let me start with Russia, about which I haven't said very much, but Russia's in the news a lot for obvious reasons, for invading Ukraine in February 2022, still being there for the and Western countries are deeply involved in helping out Ukraine. You know, NATO expanded, Finland and Sweden joined, and so on. What does that have to do with my what does Russia's action have to do with my argument? Well, some of my colleagues argue that Russia invaded Ukraine because it wanted to stop NATO expansion, the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, the security alliance that most of Europe belongs to now, and the United States and Canada. And Russia's particular worry was that the United States military, which is by far the world's largest and most capable, which is already, you know, near Russia in the Black Sea, in Poland, in the Baltics, is now wants to gobble up Ukraine, and that simply won't do. So it's a straight security calculation on the part of Putin. My response to that is it really plausible, even to Vladimir Putin, that NATO was going to invade Russia? Western powers over the centuries have learned that that's one of the stupidest things you can do, invade Russia, right? Napoleon learned, the Germans learned in World War I, they learned in an even bigger way in World War II, and we could go back in history as well. It just never works. Russia's too big. It has all these inherent advantages over a land invader. So now maybe Putin really thought that some U.S. president in the future is going to invade Russia, but I don't think that's credible. But Putin was worried. What was he worried about? He's worried about what we call the color revolutions. And this is linked to the expansion of NATO. It's not completely separate. But color revolutions are the nickname for a number of liberal democratic revolution, some more successful than others, that took place mostly in Eastern and Southeastern Europe in the 21st century. Ukraine itself went through the Orange Revolution and then the Maidan Revolution later. Georgia, Serbia, these are countries that Russia have historically been in Russia's sphere of influence. And part of that seems to mean they have authoritarian governments like Russia and Belarus. Belarus is definitely in Russia's sphere of influence. Putin knows, and the European Union knows, and the Americans, everyone knows, that the question of which country, which power, Russia or the West, these smaller countries align with, is entangled in the question of what kind of regime they have. Authoritarian countries, in that part of the world at least, are more likely to lean Russia's way. Liberal democratic states, much more likely to lean toward Europe and the West, meaning the United States. So the other problem Putin would have with Ukraine becoming a stable democracy, and it's not a stable democracy. It had problems with corruption and all kinds of instability. But the other problem is a kind of contagion that Putin is afraid of and other Russians are afraid of. If on Russia's border, in fact, lots of Russians think Ukraine really is a part of Russia. It's just like a little brother. But if it becomes a stable, prosperous liberal democracy, it's going to create a lot of doubt in the minds of ordinary Russians about why is Russia authoritarian? Why do we have this strong man in charge? My cousin over, or my uncle or my nephew over in Ukraine, seems to have a much better life, a lot more freedom, a lot more consumer goods, a lot more life chances, can travel freely. How come we don't have that here? Right. So multiply that by several million people, and Russia's also afraid of a kind of a democratic contagion. So my argument is Russia is to bring this back to the argument of the book. Russia Vladimir Putin is trying to shape Russia's physical and political environment to keep democracy at bay, to so that he doesn't want Russia's environment to select for democracy. And he really thinks that's what the United States and Europe are pushing. They have an insatiable appetite for more and more countries. They're not going to stop at anything. Now, if you read Putin's rhetoric, this is the sort of thing he says, all right? So Putin really thinks ecologically about Russia and its environment. Staying in power, making Russia a great power, is not just about his remaining in power in Russia, keeping all the nuclear warheads, rearming. It really is about Russia's neighborhood, right? So that's ecological thinking. China is doing this in a different way. China does not invade other countries, not yet. Maybe Taiwan, though I'd be surprised if China invaded Taiwan anytime soon. They might blockade Taiwan, but I don't think they'll invade. But China's way of shaping its environment is a bit different. And I've already hinted at some of this. China is much more about international rules and discourse, much more about information. So another element of the international environment I haven't talked about, Chris, is the information environment. And by that, I mean countries and systems of government have international reputations. And at certain times and places, democracy has a much stronger reputation as a successful regime than at other times. At other times, autocracy or fascism has a much stronger reputation. So in the 30s, one of my favorite cases to cite, not because it's a happy time, it was a miserable time, but it's really instructive to look back at the 30s. In the 30s, part of the crisis of liberal democracy was that democracy was really underperforming. It didn't seem equipped to handle the Great Depression. The fascist countries, Italy, Nazi Germany, some of the Latin American countries were much more authoritarian, and they had full employment. Now, yeah, Germany gets full employment because it grows its military by leaps and bounds. That's how you put all these young men to work. But nonetheless, they're at work. And meanwhile, in the United States, Franklin Roosevelt's trying this, that, and the other. It's working more slowly, if at all, right? So fascism spread in part because it was really doing pretty well. 1990s, completely opposite story. The better system, it was quite clear in the 90s, was liberal democracy, free markets, right? As Margaret Thatcher liked to say, there is no alternative. And at the time, it really didn't seem there was. Well, what about now? It's a mixed story, right? So liberal democracies are still the wealthiest countries, with some exceptions in the Persian Gulf, and but by and large, unless you are absolutely oil and gas rich and small, like say the UAE, your best bet is to be a liberal democracy. However, China has had striking success as an illiberal non-democracy, but a capitalist country. And we have lots and lots of data on this, that the Chinese narrative about how to have a successful country in the 21st century has really gotten a big following out there. Lots of authoritarians and would-be authoritarians admire China openly. They say things like, and here, you know, Lula, the president of Brazil, I'm not saying he's exactly like China, but he has said very admiring things about China in the past. That you have this political stability, which Brazil has often lacked. You have steady economic growth, actually quite strong economic growth. And you don't have to put up with a lot of the hazards that come from democracy, from multi-party liberal democracy. So, and it's hard to say that's completely wrong. The Chinese have done really well. You know, maybe China has peaked. There's a lot of talk now about how China's economic growth is permanently slowed, but still, maybe 5% this year. That's not bad, right? The other thing the Chinese are doing is they are propagating the story. They're not just passively letting the story get out there. They are putting the story out there about China's, the superiority of what's sometimes called the China model of development. They were doing this quite actively during COVID early on. So even if we say, you know, COVID comes out of China, How can they? Well, they handled it through severe lockdowns, and early in the pandemic, we're doing quite a bit better than the Western countries. Later in the pandemic's a different story. But my point is just the Chinese exploit whatever they can to get their story across. And here again, they're no different from Western countries. The United States has what we call public diplomacy. It tells its story too. Chinese aren't doing anything out of bounds here. But both the Chinese and the Americans are trying to fill the international environment with information that favors their model. All right. China, I've already said, is also working to alter the rules of the international human rights regime. So a couple of things about that. It's pretty interesting. For years, they've been working with what's called the like-minded group at the United Nations to change the way the UN does its human rights reports. So the UN does individual country reports, you know, on Iran or on in China or the United States for that matter. They also traditionally allow NGOs, non-governmental organizations such as Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch, influence over these reports. These NGOs have a place at the table. The Chinese have never liked either. They don't want these pesky NGOs who they don't like us. They're against us. They also don't like these individual country reports because they feel singled out by them. So they work very hard to eliminate the single country reports and to get the NGOs out of the room. And they've had more success in the latter, actually. They want just states. The UN is about countries, not NGOs. So, right. The Chinese also are working very hard with the Russians and some other countries to alter the discourse about human rights, the global discourse. They've been working this problem since 1989 in the Tiananmen Square massacre that followed, that was years ago, but the long and short of it is, millions of students, mostly students in China, filled Tiananmen Square in Beijing and other major cities in China, calling for more democracy. Deng Xiaoping, who was quite a remarkable leader and was responsible mostly for the opening up of China to the global economy, but he also didn't want China to become a democracy. I thought that would be bad for China. China would fall apart. So he sent in the tanks to suppress this protest in Tiananmen Square in 1989, thinking that, you know, the West won't like it, but they'll get over it. Well, the Western countries and Japan slapped severe economic sanctions on China and didn't lift them for a long time. So this set China back economically. It jeopardized Deng Xiaoping's grand program for making China a great power. It set them back a few years. And so there are real consequences to the human rights discourse is not just talks, not just words. It has real consequences. So the Chinese have been trying to broaden and alter the way the whole world thinks about human rights. Human rights regime was really set up by the West after World War II. There's this Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948, mostly Western author, not completely. It emphasizes individual rights, liberalism. It's a liberal document. The Chinese say, well, that's all well and good for some countries, but we think a more important human right is the right to economic development. And that's what we're working on. We also think the right to national independence is really important. And need we remind you that the same West that keeps talking about individual liberty was the West that colonized most of the rest of the world. We think that they're just doing the same thing now through different methods. We think that the human rights regime is really a sneaky device to keep China and other countries down. It is not really about helping the human race. It's about keeping us down. So we want to change that. We think this whole system is deliberately biased against us, and so we're working to change it. And so I think it's a sincere, self-interested effort to alter the way the world thinks about human rights and the way the United Nations imposes issues its reports and the way countries impose sanctions based on human rights. So that's just a piece of what the Chinese are doing to try to reshape the international environment to favor themselves and their type of regime.
Thank you so much. So you close the book by advocating for something you call pluralistic liberalism. Could you just give us a quick overview of what this looks like and maybe outline the steps that we could take for the world to get there?
Yes, I will at least get us started. I don't have a full program. I wish I did. I haven't figured out enough what I think pluralistic liberalism should be. But I start with the same question that I claim liberals in the past have started with when there's something wrong with society, with liberal society. We ask, what is the chief, but we want to preserve individual liberty because we're liberals, small L liberals. What's the chief barrier to individual freedom right now in our time? Not 100 years ago, not 200 years ago, right now. And I think it is the excesses of open liberalism and the what has become a really almost imposed fluidity or the virtue of open liberalism is it really says you are an autonomous chooser. You can choose a kind of life, where you live, the kind of life you live, things like when and how you die. I mean, this is extending through almost, cradle to grave. And, you know, there are many things to admire in that kind of freedom, but it is experienced and felt as a kind of imposition by many people who actually just would like to commit to a community, to commit to a career. It's for whatever reason, I don't study this, it's hard to get and stay married now. So to personal commitments seem, statistically just harder to do. So in all kinds of ways, small communities are emptying out, as they've done some in the past, but it seems to be accelerating now. So a liberalism that values and doesn't penalize long-term commitment, I think is one way to think about that. That's where I would start. And, other people might disagree. They would start somewhere else. But I think that's, if I think about what is really responsible for the alienation of so many people in wealthy Western democracies from their own governments and their own regimes, their own societies, this is where I start. And so what to do about that? That's where, so I have to, I punt on this one, Chris. I say, look, the other liberalisms, none of them was the product of a single mind. You can say John Maynard Keynes in this country played a huge role in welfare liberalism, sure, but he was standing on the shoulders of other people. And he would say that, right? Classical liberalism, my goodness, Adam Smith, Thomas Jefferson, founder of my own university, University of Virginia. Yeah, all these people, but there are other people as well. And so I give myself an excuse not to lay out a grand program for pluralistic liberalism, but I do want to get it started, get people thinking about not rejecting liberalism. I think one hazard here is some of the people who don't like open liberalism think the problem is liberalism itself. There's a whole movement, mostly on the political right in the United States, post-liberalism. Sounds like it's not anti-liberal, but it's post-liberal, like we're moving on. I think that's a bad bet. I think it can lead to some very bad places. And maybe we're starting to see some of that. So I think, no, we want to hold on to liberalism, but as we've done in the past, rethink it really deeply. And then start looking at laws and policies, including international institutions that maybe need to be reformed, tweaked. Maybe we need to create some new ones and retire some old ones. I don't know. That's far beyond what where I've gone with this. But getting back to a question you asked me earlier about whether it's unidirectional that these changes in liberalism and whether it might be time to return to welfare liberalism. Again, I don't think that's possible, a wholesale return, but I do think a serious grappling with where liberalism has gone wrong needs to try to learn from past liberalisms, right? And welfare, and I think maybe classical has some things to teach us now, because open is not the same as classical. So that's as far as you're trying to lure me into saying more than I probably want to say now, but I want to get this. I really want to get help get the ball rolling so that people will pick it up and run with it. People with other ideas who who are economists and lawyers and do comparative politics and all sorts of things that I don't do. I want them to be working this problem. But again, not saying if only we could, you know, Americans, if only we could move past Donald Trump, everything would be great again. Brexit's a problem, and these kind of people who want to destroy the EU. If only we get past that. No, I think that's ignoring the problem. You know, why did Trump happen? It's not why is he still around? He's not just around. You know, he's the favorite to win in the fall. What's going on there? You can't just treat Trump and the Trump phenomenon as this thing that landed from Mars and can be ejected, and the system will re-equilibrate as before. No. He's a creature of open liberalism, is my claim. And so you can't simply wait for him to leave the scene and then restore things the way they were. We have to rethink liberalism itself.
Fantastic. And that's a great call to others to weigh in on their thoughts on this as well. So I'm going to finish off our conversation by asking you a question, which is actually you posed at the beginning of your book. Democracy and autocracy. The current U.S. president often asserts are in global competition. The winner will shape the 21st century. Is this true, you ask? So I just want to turn this back around onto you. Given what we've talked about, given your research, do you believe this is true?
I do believe it's true. Yeah, I think the book is trying to explain why I think it's true and to make the case that it's true. Now, I want to say it sounds a bit scary to some people, right? Some people don't like this talk because they think, this sounds like Soviet American communism, you know, versus democracy. The world's only big enough for one of us, and this could lead to World War III. Let's not talk this way. I get that critique, but saying that there's a contest between these two systems does not mean it does mean that China and the U.S. are in a real contest, not just about words, not just about rules, but it is between the two countries, right? So it can get dangerous. I think it's unavoidable as long as the two giant countries keep their systems of government. That's just the way, because they exist in a common environment and they want to shape it to their advantage. So that's just, the problem is baked in. And I like liberal democracy. So I don't wish, you know, I don't wish China ill. I've been to China 3 times. I don't want China to collapse or anything like it. I would love to see China become more liberal and democratic. I don't think that's going to happen anytime soon. But I think this is the system under which human flourishing is most possible under modern conditions. And that's, you know, where I put my chips. So I don't think we can pretend there's no deep conflict, but I also think it's manageable. I don't think anything like World War III or even a Cold War has to happen. I think managed competition is, and I think the Chinese quietly agree with this as well. I hope so. I don't think China wants to rule the world, but China does want to protect its interest in its regime. And so what we need to do is manage this competition as best we can. What that looks like in practice, you know, sometimes the U.S. and China have done this better than others. Europe plays a really key role. The Russia war in Ukraine and Russia's kind of becoming closer to China has forced European countries, the UK, Germany, EU as a whole, to confront some decisions they were putting off. And so we may be looking at not a bipolar world, but something that's moving more in that direction than we want. That also is something that I talk about at the end of the book. You know, what's world order going to look like? Are we looking at two systems coming up? And I think not necessarily, but we shouldn't fool ourselves into thinking we're all trying to do the same thing here. And it's just one big misunderstanding. It's actually a pretty clear understanding of what's at stake for the Chinese who want to keep their system and the West, which wants to keep its system.
Thank you. Well, I think that sounds like a great place for us to finish. Before we do, I just want to ask you, is there anything you'd like to share with our audience, our listeners, anything, any more work that's coming up, any research you'd like to share?
Yes, I am. Now continuing to kind of work over this argument and think about implications of it. And one, I'm writing a paper now, about halfway done, on how political scientists and others who work in the field of international order, international institutions, on the one hand, and political scientists who work in the subfield of international conflict, war and peace, need to talk more to each other. These are two separate scholarly communities, not completely separate, but they don't read each other's material as much as they should. And I'm making the argument that this rivalry between, or this contest between the U.S. and I'll broaden it to the West on the one hand, and China and Russia on the other, over international order, the shape and content of international order, is actually entangled in the U.S.-China security competition. You can't simply treat them as completely separate. The governments don't think they're completely separate. And so my argument tells, kind of describes why they're entangled. They're kind of entwined with each other. That's one thing I'm thinking about. I'm also going to be thinking about the future of liberalism, since you asked, and want to do a bit more thinking and reading about that. I'm not a trained political theorist, but I have relatives. My brother happens to be one, and my son is training to be one. So we have good conversations about all this. And so I want to think through that in cooperation with lots of other people, because I think it's a big project. So those are two things I'm thinking about now.
Thank you so much, Professor John Owen. Thank you so much for speaking to the Ballpark today.
My great pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Professor John Owen is the Ambassador Henry J. and Mrs. Marion R. Taylor Professor of Politics and Senior Fellow at the Institute for Advanced Studies and Culture, the Miller Center for Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. From January through June 2024, he is an academic visitor at Nuffield College at the University of Oxford. You can check out our show notes for Professor Owen's recent article, How Pluralistic Liberalism Can Protect Democracy in a Time of Contested World Order, on the Phelan U.S. Center's blog, USAP. And that's it for this extra inning of the Ballpark. Thanks so much to Professor John Owen for joining us in this episode. For more information about the LSE Phelan U.S. Center, you can go to www.lse.ac.uk/united-states. And on Twitter and Instagram, we're at @LSE_US. On Facebook, we're LSE United States. This extra inning was produced by Chris Gilson and Anderson Tan. Our theme tune is by Ranger and the Rearrangers, a Seattle-based gypsy jazz band. You can look them up at rangerswings.com. To listen to all our previous episodes, just enter LSE Ballpark into your search engine of choice. You'll find us. We're free to listen to, and like lots of other podcasts, we're ad-free. We'd love to hear what you think about the show. Email us any feedback at uscenter@lse.ac.uk, or you can send us a tweet at @LSE_US. And please tell your friends about us. If you like what you've heard, then please rate and review us via your podcast platform. It helps other people find the show. The content and opinions expressed in this podcast do not reflect those of the Phelan U.S. Center or of the London School of Economics. Thanks for listening.